Well, thank you very much for coming here. My name is Peter Thompson, and we're going to talk about civil liberties and national security. And I know people have a lot of strong opinions because I've been doing this up here for about 8 years. In fact, before the Iraq War started, I was doing just war things up here. People couldn't believe there'd ever be an Iraq War. And so I'm going to save a lot of time to learn from you folks. And they have me listed as a guest lecturer. This is a serendipitous Holden Village moment. The guest lecturer has a guest lecturer. I was laying the underlayment out there for the floor today, trying to visit, make it hard to hear in here for the other presenters. And Judge Jack Nevin came up to me and said, haven't you been here on earlier years, and haven't we talked about this and everything? So we started talking for a while. And I thought, what a perfect contributor here. And only at Holden could this happen. And probably only at Holden would someone be courageous enough to actually volunteer. So when we get done with my spiel and introduction and a look at whether or not everything has changed since 9/11, or there's a little different historical perspective, we're going to open this up pretty much. And not only will I take questions, but Brigadier General Nevin will take questions. Jack is now in his 11th year as a trial judge in Tacoma, Washington. Before then, he did trial work, a lot of municipalities and other clients like that. And he has been for 32 years an Army JAG officer. And in fact, he's been nominated recently for a position that would relate to some of these Guantanamo cases we're going to talk about, to be on an appellate panel for some of the detainees who would be designated enemy combatants and wanted to appeal that designation. But a lot of that technical thing, I don't want to constrain you too much. We could talk about and use the whole hour about any one of these top words, you know, like take torture, and we'd be gone for about 3 hours. So what I'm going to do is basically outline what civil liberties are, what your civil rights are, and I'm going to give you some time while I'm doing a little historical background to think about the question in two ways. Is national security really dialectically opposed to civil liberties, number one? In other words, can we either have one or the other, or is it possible, you know, that there can be some reconciliation of these things? And I'm going to ask people, you know, who have strong feelings about this either way, to address this when we get done. And then Judge Nevin and I will take questions and we'll facilitate additional discussion. The other question is, to the extent they are reconcilable, these two things, national security or civil liberties, or are not reconcilable, where are you as a citizen of the United States and as a Christian, if you are a Christian, willing to draw the line as to giving up any of these civil liberties? And I'll run through them, basically what they are. And they come from very complex sources, you know, international treaties, our constitution, statutory law, common law, all sorts of places. So we'll try and make this not too technical a legal discussion, but we'll give you some general background. So I'll give you some general background, and there have been four cases decided on the Guantanamo detainees, which really have crystallized a lot of these issues. And one of them came down on June 12th. And it was probably the most significant one, Bomedien versus Bush. And it was about whether or not the Guantanamo detainees could bring habeas corpus actions. And I'll kind of tell you what that is about. But in the opinion, which I brought up here to study, the majority, which is a 5-4 majority, 5-4 ruling, and the majority ruled, and the majority opinion is written by Justice Kennedy, who was no great liberal, but he's kind of the swing vote on the Supreme Court now in a lot of these issues. They ruled, yes, that the Guantanamo detainees did have the right to bring constitutionally habeas corpus petitions, which is, does anyone know what habeas corpus means?
Produce the body.
Yep, free the body. So, and it started way back, kind of along with the Magna Carta, as like the catalyst for actually asserting rights in England. And habeas corpus, therefore, can encompass any of these rights we have, statutory, international, constitutional rights. It's a way that if someone is locked away in a jail somewhere and he can find a next friend or a lawyer or someone, can file a petition and say, I'm being unlawfully held, here are the circumstances, free me. And there's some wonderful old history about all that. But this case was about habeas corpus. And without going into all the details of the case, I just want to read to you one thing that Justice Kennedy said in the majority opinion, which really bears on what we're going to talk about tonight. National security and civil liberties. And also, he kind of intimates whether or not these would be mutually exclusive. Many people in our political dialogues have become increasingly vitriolic, I will say, really think of it as either or. And there are some good arguments that it would be either or. But it's interesting what Justice Stevens said, or Justice Kennedy. Secure, at this point, this is kind of late in his opinion on page 40. He said, security depends upon a sophisticated intelligence apparatus and the ability of our armed forces to act and to interdict. Stop them before they do it. There are further considerations, however. Security subsists, too, in fidelity to freedom's first principles. Chief among these are freedom from arbitrary and unlawful restraint and the personal liberty that is secured by adherence to the separation of powers. It is from these principles that the judicial authority to consider petitions for habeas corpus relief derives. And he's writing that in anticipation of the dissent, which says basically, in much longer terms, that the court is becoming way too activist now, that these are matters of foreign policy, it has to be left to the executive to make these decisions about national security on a fast basis, and the court shouldn't be sticking their nose in this business. And he's pointing out that in his view, at least in the view of the five people in the majority, it is a more complex interplay than that, and that actually civil liberties do have quite a bit to do with how secure we may be. So, with that said, I'll just indicate what our civil liberties are generally thought to be. Free speech and freedom of religion in the First Amendment to the Constitution. And I'm going to tick these off so you can think about which of these you would be willing to compromise for greater safety or security, or if compromising them would give you greater safety or security. And it is recognized there, and none of us want to get blown up in a second attack. And it is recognized there that we have, the government has an obligation, one of its first obligations to its people, to keep them safe. So, freedom of speech and freedom of religion. A big one that's been written a lot about now, freedom from torture, freedom from cruel and unusual punishment, or cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment or punishment. Due process of law, and due process of law in the context of Guantanamo, and in many civil contexts, such as the trials that Judge Nevin conducts, really means fair trial. In a lot of ways. That is notice of what the charges are against you, right to have counsel present to help you out, right to be presumed innocent, right to prove your innocence, right to have the power of subpoenas, you know, right to have the burden of proof on the prosecution, all those sorts of fundamental things we think about as part of a fair trial. Equal protection of laws. That comes up a lot in terms of gender bias or other biases. If you know, know, different parties are being treated fairly, racial bias. It's a very important fundamental constitutional equal protection of law. And the other one I issued was privacy. And that's hot now in the whole war on terrorism because the Patriot Act and now the FISA court you hear about on the TV and the radio from time to time. There was a period of time when the executive was eavesdropping or wiretapping without court approval. There's a special court that's set up for foreign intelligence. And now then that was amended in Congress for a period of time. Now they're talking about extending that. So whatever, how all those things come down, when you talk about privacy, you talk about the right to be secure in your home from illegal searches, the right to be secure in your thoughts and your intimacies, such as there's a famous GLBT case where they said the sodomy statute's unconstitutional because people's most intimate relationships shouldn't be spied on by the government. And then, most dramatically, there's wiretapping and eavesdropping. And the government says we need to wiretap and eavesdrop because we want to stop another 9/11 attack. And the ACLU says, you know, that's against our fundamental rights and against our Constitution and against the principles that this country was founded. So that's basically the rights I'm talking about. And the reason habeas corpus was so important, and I actually went out and listened to the argument in Beaumediene, is because habeas corpus encompasses all those rights. If someone is in jail and because of a violation of one of those rights, one lawsuit can raise those rights, and it's habeas corpus. In fact, at the founding moments of our country, there was a big debate. Should we have a Bill of Rights, or wouldn't that really be able to get through all the different states? The states had to ratify it. And the final decision was, no, let's wait on the Bill of Rights. They're quite controversial. But we'll ensure everyone's rights by putting into the Constitution that the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended, except in times of rebellion or invasion. And that will cover every one of the rights. And in fact, that's how it has operated. And then about 10 years later, they did put in the Bill of Rights. So it just wasn't explicit at the start, but it was implicit in the right of habeas corpus. So that's why this Beaumediene case was, in my opinion, and in many other lawyers' opinions, a huge one. Okay.
So does habeas corpus include then search and seizure, unreasonable search and seizure?
It can include any of these. In other words, if you're in jail because the police have seized some marijuana at your house, then you can say, I'm being held illegally because that search was illegal. Pardon me?
How do you know they did that? That's a joke.
We won't go further.
Okay.
Okay.
But is unreasonable search and seizure?
It's right here.
Okay, for privacy.
Right of privacy.
Okay. Now, the other question I want to ask, and there's some context, Scalia wrote just in a recent gun case that the right of the people to keep and bear arms, and that's the same language, I believe it's the Fourth Amendment.
Second Amendment.
Second Amendment that says the right of the people to be secure in their persons.
That's the Fourth Amendment.
Okay, the Fourth Amendment.
The Fourth Amendment is to be secure in your property and your person.
Right, and it says the right of the people in both of those, and that was what Scalia said, because that said the right of the people, that has been granted to the people and can't be infringed on with guns. And so there's some thinking that the same thing goes with privacy, because that's the exact same language that he cited there.
Well, it's similar language to all of these rights. And we won't go to the gun case because that'd be another session. Because we got our hands really full with this national security. Okay, so start thinking. I've given you everything you need to start thinking about your position on those, but I'm just going to now give you a little historical background on the basic argument that really has been made since 9/11 is that this event was completely new. Everything's changed, and so these kind of legal protections or the way the executive needs to respond, particularly in a time of war or other kind of national emergency, is different. And so we're writing on a new slate, so a lot of these things that the government now wants to do should be given a fresh look, and we should have a little empathy for them because it's a new world. And you've probably all heard that, it's a new world. And in particular, they've said, we're going to lose this war on terrorism unless we can stay ahead of the terrorists. And the only way we're going to stay ahead of the terrorists is through intelligence, investigation, and aggressive interrogation. They don't say torture, they say aggressive interrogation. And so we need to put aside a lot of these things that we are neat little civil liberties that we've been talking about for years, because we don't want to lose the war on terrorism, because we don't want to get blown up. Okay, now this is just one little piece. We're going to say, this is the argument, everything has changed since 9/11. We're just going to do a little historical, real quick thing through as to whether or not this is really unique. And obviously it's unique. Every event in the world is unique, and every crisis is unique. But I just want to go back and look at a few of them and see what some of the legal responses have been, or governmental responses have been, just as a context for you to think about this national security and civil liberties.
Okay.
Okay, so we'll go back to about the start of our country, and at the very beginning, the Brits and the French were warring with each other. And we had a little mini war in Washington because the Federalists and the Republicans took sides in that, and they were warring with each other. And I'm no great historian, so I might have some of these details wrong. I know John Adams is a Federalist, and so they passed a couple of different acts. One is the Alien Friends Act, and it allowed for deportation of any dangerous non-citizen. When you see terms like this, like alien, unlawful enemy combatant, or dangerous non-citizen, things like that, that's what triggers us into, oh, well, maybe we've dealt with this sort of thing before. The deportations were allowed without charge, jury trial, right to counsel. And a congressman who was serving at the time, Edward Livingston, had this comment about it: all is darkness, silence, mystery, and suspicion. Then
was that law repealed?
Yes, it was. Yeah. We're getting there. Then the Sedition Act of 1798 followed on its footsteps, and that act prohibited bringing the government, quote, into contempt or disrepute. It was enforced only against Republican supporters, many of whom were prosecuted. And on John Adams' last day in office, it was repealed. It caused the demise of the Federalist Party that was taking that position against the Republicans. Jefferson pardoned all those who were convicted. And 40 years later, Congress repaid the fines of those who had been convicted. The act was condemned by the Supreme Court as unconstitutional and the Court of History. In the Civil War, Lincoln, when our republic certainly was imperiled and there was rebellion and invasion, so there was a chance that you could legally suspend habeas corpus that we've talked about, he suspended habeas corpus 8 different times. And in one of his suspensions, he said that it was going to, that all guilty of disloyal practice would be subject to court-martial. And 13,000 different people were imprisoned without judicial review because it was an executive kind of court. In this sort of situation in martial law, the executive branch of the government is judge, jury, and legislature, because they make up the laws. Okay. The result of at least that suspension of the habeas corpus was the case of Ex parte Milligan, where the Supreme Court ruled that Lincoln had exceeded his constitutional authority, even though it was wartime, because, and the litmus test they applied there, lawyers like bright lines and litmus tests, was that the civil courts were open. They rejected the argument that due to the war, the executive had the right to function as supreme legislator, supreme judge, and supreme executive. One funny interesting thing about that is I read the Milligan case. You know how everything is so scientifically and technologically known now. It was clear in reading the Milligan decision that the Supreme Court justices, even though they were deciding the case, didn't know if he'd been hung or not yet. On the one hand, they heard he'd been hung, but on the other hand, they said since his lawyers came and argued his case, they had to presume that he was still alive. So I thought that was rather funny. Then, movement that has really been called terroristic was an anarchist movement that was really global. At the turn of the century, there were numerous assassinations. A U.S. president, who was that?
McKinley.
The Empress of Austria, one of the leaders of Russia, and then finally, later at the start of World War I, the Archduke Ferdinand. And that wave of terrorism, and they called it terrorism, they called completely unprecedented and never having occurred before in human history. So it was a grave threat internationally, not just to one country. In World War I, some of the responses by the Congress were the Espionage Act of 1917, which prohibited seditious utterances. Attorney General Gregory said, "May God have mercy on war dissenters, for they need expect none from an outraged people and an avenging government." They formed a committee for public information and created a flood of inflammatory information against all things German. Then there were two other acts, the Espionage Act of 1917 and the Sedition Act of 1918. 2,000 dissenters were prosecuted, and loyal Americans were asked to act as voluntary detectives. Supreme Court affirmed the convictions of these people, and all genuine war debate was suppressed. It's interesting, I have a source for this. Almost all this information is in a brief that was submitted to the Supreme Court in the first of the Guantanamo cases. A guy named Jeffrey Stone, who's a law professor at the University of Chicago, put together this, asking the Supreme Court to hear this case, and his argument was basically, we've been here many times before, and here's what happens if the rule of law is not vindicated. Some of these past embarrassments. Okay. The Supreme Court's performance was wretched during that period of time. When Roosevelt came, he granted amnesty to all those convicted, and all the precedents were overruled as violative of the First Amendment that came up in those prosecutions. Next, in our own history, the Red Scare of 1919. J. Edgar Hoover was appointed the head of the General Intelligence Division. 5,000 alien filth were arrested and 1,000 were deported. The result was the Department of Justice, it was concluded, had acted without legal authorization, and the secret police is a menace to free government and free institutions. So all of this history, do you hear this in the history books, or do we think of this, or is this, I mean, I was amazed when I found this guy's brief to see what had happened. I mean, these aren't proud moments, so they aren't always lifted up when you're in junior high in American history. The Nazi rise to power, interestingly, they called the International Bolsheviks a terrorist conspiracy and used that, frightening the public as the Nazis began to pass the law into their national socialist agenda. Remember, everything the Nazis did was authorized by law. The World War II Japanese internment. 120,000 were interned beginning February 19, 1942. The famous U.S. Supreme Court case, which affirmed the conviction of Fred Korematsu, just this part of the country. Fred committed the crime of not leaving his house. He was given the first directive from the relocation division that he had to stay at home. He couldn't leave his home. All Japanese Americans received it. The second directive he got from them was that he had to go to an internment center, turn himself in for a shipment off to an internment center. His argument was that I had two conflicting directions, and so I'm going to do nothing and follow the first one, and he was convicted of a felony and sent to prison. The U.S. Supreme Court affirmed his conviction. And the attorneys were all held until after the election in 1944, and then they were released. Milton Eisenhower resigned as a result and made some statements after the fact, of course, about the terrible injustice that this was. The Attorney General at the time showed that the episode showed the power of suggestion, which a mystic cliche like military necessity can exercise. And years later, President Ford sent a $20,000 check to all the surviving internees. We had one of the internees here, and he did a presentation a few years ago. And Ben Sakamoto, who worked on carpentry with me, and he said he took his $20,000 check and framed it and put it on the wall. He said because $20,000 wasn't going to repay him for what his family and people had been through. The Cold War and McCarthyism. The McCarran Act was passed in 1950, even though Truman wanted to veto it. And the Communist Control Act of 1954 was unanimous with only one dissenting vote, Estes Kefauver. It outlawed the Communist Party, and it created blacklists, loyalty programs, and the Supreme Court upheld those investigations and convictions. The court later effectively has overruled those communist convictions on First Amendment grounds and recognized the nation had been led astray by the emotions and fears of the moment. A couple of personal experiences I had. In 1985, I went on a human rights mission to Sri Lanka, and we met with both the guerrillas who were involved in a war that started in 1983 and the government. And the government said that they had had to suspend their constitution with regard to notice of charges and presenting people for trial, and had to detain these people because they were terrorists. And they said, we know who the terrorists are. This is a different thing. If you people in the United States understood what terrorists were, you would understand why we can't follow either international protocols for human rights or our own constitution. And they're around Jaffna in the north, and they're around Trincomalee in the east. And after we kill them all, we can return to our constitutional system. Well, it's 2008, and they're still fighting. And they haven't returned to the constitutional system. And I also had an opportunity to go to India on a human rights mission in 1993 and found a very similar situation in Punjab, in the northwestern part of India, where there was a Sikh separatist movement, and the government was saying exactly the same thing to us. We were human rights advocates, and they had suspended their constitutional guarantees. And they said these people are terrorists, and once we ferret them out and can kill them, then we can go back to our constitutional structure. So that's a little trip through those kind of historical moments. So in terms of these civil liberties, the situation you're in now, the fact that you don't want your family to get blown up in another 9/11 or a similar event, we want to be secure. How do people feel about this dilemma, this poll? And you can make a statement, you can ask a question, you can direct it either to Judge Evan or myself, and we can discuss these issues. I would think that once someone has asked a question, let's wait until anyone else who'd like to ask a question has had the opportunity before we go back to that person. Yes, sir.
the suspension of habeas, the initial legislation was not limited to the Guantanamo detainees. It was also, it could include the American public.
No.
I don't know if I'm right about that or not.
No, it didn't include the American public. It was specific as to the Guantanamo detainees. And it's actually a long history, and I won't go into all of it, but first it was done not congressionally. It was done by executive action. Then the Rasool case came up, and there was four cases, Rasool, Hamdi, Hamdan, and Boumediene. And after those three cases came up, then Congress went back and passed a law that said there would be no habeas for the Guantanamo detainees. But the first time it was done by executive order only. And then the validity of that law, called the Military Commissions Act, is what just went up and was struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court in that 5-4 opinion. But at no time did it say the U.S. citizen couldn't have a right of habeas, that I know of.
No. No, and in fact, the question in Bowman-Dean is, do you allow habeas to every person who is on American soil, which for the purposes of that case would include Guantanamo? Justice Kennedy, in his opinion, said, no, we're talking about the right of habeas as it relates to these detainees, because there are groups who do not otherwise enjoy, or non-citizens who don't necessarily enjoy a habeas right, and I think that's the point that Justice Kennedy was trying to make.
And that's not to say that no non-citizens can file habeas. In fact, many non-citizens can file habeas, but there are differing circumstances.
Would you just refresh me about who all these people are in Guantanamo? Where did they come from? But just who are they all?
Yeah, that would, that's a big question. There were about 600 at one time. There's an excellent book on this in the bookstore about Guantanamo and the abuse of presidential war powers by Joe Margulies, who practiced law with me. And he was the lead counsel in the Rasul case, the first case. And he goes through a lot of history on this. At its height, I think there were about 600 detainees. I think there are about 225 now. Many have been sent back to their home countries. I think in almost all instances, they have been released at their home countries. I think six so far have been rearrested on the battlefield of those ones who have been released, 400 or so. Of the 225 who are now there, about 20 have been designated as having committed war crimes and are being held for trial before a military commission. And you read about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the alleged mastermind of 9/11, and others. And I should just bring this up. Omar Khadr was 15 at the time he was arrested in Afghanistan. He's one of the 20, and I am doing legal work for him, volunteer legal work in his case, because it's probably the next one that's going to come up for trial. And the only case that's really been disposed of in the military commission is David Hicks, who's an Australian. And he took a plea bargain for 1 year. He was caught fighting with the Taliban, and he's been sent back to Australia to finish the 1 year in Australian confinement. And these people have come from everywhere. In Boumediene, there were at least six who were in Bosnia. They were Muslim. They were arrested. They were released by the Bosnian courts. American military intelligence picked them up and brought them to Guantanamo. And so they were not alleged to be involved in any of the overt fighting in either Afghanistan or Iraq, but they were under suspicion of or under investigation for being connected to or supporting Al-Qaeda.
What did the guy do that you were looking into? What is he accused of, the one that you're accused of?
He is accused of being in a firefight in a little village in Afghanistan and throwing a hand grenade just before the compound collapsed that landed right in front of Sergeant Spears, who was an army medic, and he was immediately killed. So he's charged with murder. His defense is another guy in the compound threw the hand grenade, and also has a lot of international defenses, that he was a child soldier, that his father, who basically brought him to Afghanistan, was the one who was interested in this whole thing, that he had never been in any fighting. And, you know, it's a long story. And they have, as in almost all these cases, they have very little independent evidence they do have against Cotter, that's one of the reasons they're charging him, because to charge a 15-year-old is probably not the greatest PR. But they have from Cotter, after many denials, they also have 32 confessions. And then a lot of denials after that. So almost every one of these cases depends on confessions, which are the subject matter of a lot of suppression motions as to whether or not they have a right to have confessions that are given under extreme interrogation or torture suppressed.
Thank you.
Yeah.
In this, excuse me, in this discussion, we've heard that prisoners have been vetted to other countries for interrogation. Does this apply? In what, how do we put that in context with the Guantanamo prisoners?
Judge, you want to answer that? That's called rendition?
Rendition is something that the Department of Defense hasn't had, to my knowledge, any exposure with, but there are other federal agencies that I think arguably have been involved in that. Renditions took place earlier on. For example, Ali Sheikh Mohammed, I believe, was the object of rendition, if I'm not mistaken. And they're taken to, apparently reportedly taken to prisons at different places around the world. Mohammed was in, I believe, Poland, Eastern Poland. They've been removed from those, and those who are accused of these war crimes have been taken to Guantanamo Bay. I think that there's two points I would make, and that's that the role of the federal law enforcement agencies, specifically the CIA, to a substantially lesser degree the FBI, is a decidedly different role than the role of the Department of Defense. And in fact, the interrogation standards that President Bush signed into executive order within this last, I want to say the last 9 months or so, were followed by the Department of Defense interrogation standards, which are decidedly different than the executive branch interrogation standards. And in fact, a military member who is privy to, let alone participates in, any of these executive branch interrogation standards, whatever they're legally determined to be ultimately by the courts, is themselves subject to criminal liability. So.
And there have been a few, like one of the fellows that interrogated Cotter at Bagram Hospital, because, you know, he was in critical condition, and in Bagram Prison in Afghanistan was prosecuted, and he was also, he was prosecuted for various crimes, but the most serious of one was one of the people he interrogated died, and so he was charged with murder.
But how does the practice of rendition relate to civil liberties issues or habeas corpus or any of the, or does it at all? I mean, because it seems like a way to get around a whole lot of things, but has that been challenged?
No. And not to my knowledge, and Peter is more up to date on this. Rendition is so highly secretive and so covert that, I mean, the Department of Defense, not only are they not privy to it, they don't know about it. You have certain agencies that have historically been involved in that sort of conduct.
Yeah.
I think it's a general proposition, less so now by virtue of where we've evolved in this last 5 years. But it was so covert that I think, if not literally, virtually no one knew about it other than, say, the leaders of those particular agencies. There's a perception that all these federal agencies share information.
No. It seems to me that one of the major differences there would have been the issue of being on American soil or American controlled facilities, soil. Guantanamo is, and those are not.
Well, interestingly, that's a question. Those who were opponents, one of the issues that was litigated in Rasul was whether or not, and I'll just sort of coin this phrase, I guess, whether Guantanamo is jurisdictionally a legal no man's land, neither fish nor fowl. It's not really a United States military installation. It's really not the country of Cuba. It's this little ill-defined, undefined entity, and therefore not subject to jurisdiction of the United States federal courts, which was fairly summarily taken care of by the U.S. Supreme Court, among other issues.
You mean rejected by the Supreme Court?
Rejected
by the Supreme Court.
Rejected, actually rejected as to that issue.
Yeah. A bothersome thing about that is that it was a venue that was very specifically and knowingly selected for that very purpose. You know, as were, you know, before Congress passed some of these other laws that are now being challenged, as were every step in the process of handling these people, it was all by executive order rather than involving Congress or making information known to the public so democracy could work. I mean, there was never a thing like this. To answer your question about rendition, any U.S. official who participates in rendition is violating a federal felony statute. But what has to be done is that one of the essential elements of that crime is that they have to have reasonable grounds to believe the person will be tortured. And the defense then arises, well, you know, we don't know what's going to happen when he's sent to Syria for interrogation. And everyone can chuckle about it, but if you're a prosecutor, as I was, and you know the person says, you know, I didn't know where that airplane was going, much less exactly what they were going to do, it's very hard to get a conviction.
Well, I don't have a question, but I'll take a stand.
Okay.
As I notice, not anyone has yet. So here's my stand. And I guess the basis of it is that if we sacrifice our freedoms for something that is expedient, even if it is the possible saving of lives, history demonstrates, apparently, if you want to accept the evidence that you provided, history demonstrates that we have made many mistakes in that for expediency, to attempt to avert just the kind of thing we're talking about today. But there might be, and I'm not sure you presented any evidence to this, but there might be some reason to believe that there was some very good prevention of further deaths and so forth. I don't know if that is the case. And lacking that evidence, I would say we should not sacrifice our freedoms for expediency, because I don't see that has really happened, that it in fact made a difference. And furthermore, I would say that intelligence, if you want to take that in the broad sense, means being smarter than, you know, in some ways. There's a connotation there. And I don't believe that being smarter than is removing freedoms. To me, that is not being smarter. That is just trying to remove what we think of as a shield for people to hide behind in order to get at us. And I think we can be far more intelligent than that. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm not going to take a stand, but I would like to hear either or both of your views about the effectiveness of, you know, sort of demonstrated effectiveness of the suspension of some of these rights, you know, for example, torture. As say compared to, I mean, you used a phrase about the lack of sharing of information. That happens not only within our country, but between countries and our sort of relationships with, you know, whether it's France or Spain or whatever, you know, how that intelligence sharing probably hasn't gone as well under this administration, perhaps, as in the past. But my question is, you know, how, you know, is it, are these things, is there a demonstrated effectiveness of, you know, of getting the kind of intelligence that would prevent something? I mean, I can think of, since that, you know, sharing information prior to 9/11, better information sharing, I mean, could have prevented 9/11.
I mean, as to your question about the effectiveness, the consensus is that torture doesn't work. It just generates false information. As a matter of fact, the experts from the FBI actually say that just the opposite is true, that taking the, if you will, the soft sell. You know, as to the sharing of information, I don't know. It's difficult to say. I think one thing that's important to look at is the war on terror has been going on for a long time. Khobar Barracks, the first World Trade Center, USS Cole, the embassy in Kenya. I mean, it's a real tough balance. It's what makes the essence of this presentation so important. I mean, there is a global war on terrorism, and there are people there who, to this very moment, are no doubt intent on our destruction. I mean, putting aside the question of whether certain policies have made that even more so than what existed, it exists. Yet at the same time, you know, we're a country that has evolved a lot in terms of the Bill of Rights and the Constitution since the 1950s. And in the eyes of the world, we are known for human rights, sometimes even cynically so, but we're still looked at for human rights. And I have the good fortune to go to a lot of fairly remote areas of the world and teach rule of law. And the first thing they want to know about is, how can we have the human rights that we have in the United States? Well, so now the question becomes, in the interest of national security, are you sacrificing, if you will, a certain amount of diplomatic capital? And then in one of the cases that went to the Supreme Court, when it was at the Court of Appeals at the D.C. Circuit level, the Hamdan case, three of my predecessors in my office filed a friend of the court brief on behalf of Mr. Hamdan, not because they're tied with Mr. Hamdan, but because if you draw back from what are known as the Geneva Convention rights, mm-hmm. then what you do is you put every Marine, right. sailor, so on and so forth, around the world from now in the indefinite future, you put them at risk for other leaders not following the Geneva Convention. And a lot of people say, well, our enemies don't follow the Geneva Convention. But the reality is they do. They don't follow it very well, but they do. And even today, Senator McCain says, I'm alive today because of the Geneva Convention, as poorly as he was treated.
Yeah.
So that's this incredibly delicate balance, you know. Senator Graham in one of the hearings said, as it related to the detainees, when they're talking about all these nuances to international law, whether they have rights or not, he said, just because you can doesn't necessarily mean you should.
Yes, sir. You know, it seems to me that the position taken by the executive branch of our government echoes your first slide, that their position is that, yes, 9/11 changed everything. And I find that difficult to understand, because the only thing that it changed was maybe the scale. It didn't really change anything. There was, as you say, there were terrorist activities that occurred before 9/11. It was just the magnitude and the suddenness that seemed to change everything. I don't think it changed anything. The war on terror has been going on for a long time. I don't think it's going to end anytime soon. And for us to give up rights for some small element of security, I think there are a lot of other ways to get security and safety in this government than giving up our rights that the government, the executive branch, has set aside. My position.
Paul, before I tell you your position, think a little bit about whether or not this is a war, the war on terrorism.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an interesting fundamental position, because if you talk about military necessity, you're talking about war, as opposed to if that was just one of the biggest, most gigantic crimes there ever was. Paul.
I have strong stance, but I'm just going to throw out something for information. Amnesty International Journal, right now in our library here, has a 6-page article, clear, concise, about a German citizen who spent 5 years in Guantanamo. And if you want to have a kind of a gut-wrenching story about a specific person where this, all of the political and legal structure is manifest in one man's life, it's a good read, and you can do it in 15 minutes. It's in our library here.
He was picked up on his way to Pakistan.
Yep.
Was Muslim and wasn't otherwise guilty of anything, right?
Right.
That's the guy.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, there have been several books come out like that, and he spent 5 years under interrogation, right?
5 years, and he tells specifically what happened to him at Guantanamo under the watch of American soldiers. The reason I point it out is that you don't have to read a whole book. Mm-hmm. It's a 15-minute read that will really, I think, give flesh to your thoughts.
Okay, just wait a second. I just want to make one thing before I forget it. In the cases I've been working on, and my buddy Joe Margolis made the same point in his book, some of the greatest heroes for civil liberties in these cases have been government lawyers who have been appointed to do the defense. Mm-hmm. And some of them aren't going to get, you know, one guy was threatened with court-martial, he hasn't been yet, another guy didn't get, you know, his career path was over and things like that. These guys, this guy, the lead lawyer that's going to try the case that I'm working with, he is fearless. I mean, he is basically to do his proper ethical duty, and he believes, you know, in the innocence of his client, which is nice, but that's not necessary. He just takes the government and the court and everyone to task at great personal risk. And so there have been some military, there have been FBI agents that have blown the whistle on torture. There have been government lawyers who have, you know, blown the whistle on torture memos coming out of the Office of Legal Counsel. There have been a lot of heroes on the government side. Bob, and then Tom.
I just want to say, what I know about legal things, you can write on the wall and in capital letters, but I was just thinking as you're talking, in the history of our own country, it was interesting to look at your history here. It's easy to see how frightened we can get. But Benjamin Franklin, who his own life was, you know, if Washington hadn't invaded Trenton, New Jersey on Christmas Day in 75, they probably would have hung him. And he said, those who choose security over liberty deserve me.
We have a Canadian view here up in the balcony.
I think a lot of these things raise a broader question, which is the treatment of foreign nationals on American soil, whether they're Joe tourists or someone who might be of suspicion. And the case I'm thinking of is Mayor Arar, the Canadian engineer who was born in Syria. He was taken in New York while he was changing planes between Syria and Canada, and sent to Syria, and he was imprisoned and tortured. The Canadian government has apologized to him because they didn't act to stop the grant officials from taking him. But there's been no word of anything.
No, he brought a lawsuit against the United States and it was dismissed on various legal grounds in federal court. I can't tell you what the grounds were, but
in a more general sense, I mean, I've lived in Canada for 30 years, and always when people talk about going down to the States, they said, oh, it's fine going to the States, and then we have to go through the grilling coming back, you know, our border officials are much nastier than American ones. Well, that is flip-flopped. Mm-hmm. It's different now. Mm-hmm. And you consider the reputational loss that represents for all the tourists that come to the U.S.
Yeah, as the judge put it, I think political capital, a lot has been spent over the last few years. Anyone else care?
When we try to assess some of the negative outcomes of some of these suspension of habeas corpus, it seems like one of the outcomes we should really look at is the effect on those who are given the task of carrying out the suspension or however you want to put that. I mean, an obvious example would be the Abu Ghraib. The people who are involved in that, but do we ever look at that cost? You know, because any of us who are involved with being the enforcers of this removal of rights have a significant effect as well. That might be something to look at.
Hmm. I think very particularly in the, there's a Dr. Stephen Miles who comes and talks to my class, and he said they've done studies on post-traumatic stress syndrome of people that have been in combat. And there's one level, just getting sent to a theater, you know, it increases above what it would be in this room. And then it's the next level if you actually go on missions. And it's the next level if you have seen people killed or if you have been an interrogator. That's the highest level that people, so it's not just the torture, it's what we do to ourselves, not only in terms of reputation, but in terms of the actual effects on the people. So it's a very valid concern.
Yeah, that's the, between traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress, we have just a huge complement of individuals coming back who are going through a lot of, the Veterans Administration is actually now developing a large complement of its healthcare providers devoted to just that because of the number of TBI, traumatic brain injury, as well as PTSD issues coming back. And on a, just on an international level, although Abu Ghraib has been now, I think 5 years ago, in a lot of Iraq, citizens look on Abu Ghraib as if it happened yesterday. From a purely tactical perspective in the war, it had a huge debilitating effect on this effort to instill, for example, world law.
Question?
Did you have your just a minute? Please?
Me?
Yeah.
No, I was pointing to Carol.
Oh, okay. Okay, anyone else?
A question. Will the June 12th decision have an impact on other persons that are being detained now, but that are not U.S. citizens? I mean, we have a case of somebody in it's been almost 3 years in Seattle area that there's been really no trial. Well, there's been a hearing and so forth. This person is still being detained. They haven't proved anything.
Has there been a charge filed?
Again, you know some more about this, but this is—I mean, it's right now. Before it's the last appeal was appealed to the federal panel of three federal judges, and it's been under consideration by that appellate court for the last like 2 or 3 months. The question was national security. I mean, that was this is an Iraqi refugee.
Is it an immigration case?
It began with an immigration case. But I'm wondering if you know this decision is going to have you know any impact that's broader than Guantanamo in terms of.
It does have an impact broader than Guantanamo to the extent that any place overseas now which is under our complete dominion and control. And isn't it actually a theater of conflict? People can file a writ of habeas corpus. So that's the new ground it really plowed, that there can be habeas corpus filed outside of the United States. Now, not everywhere and not in all circumstances, obviously, but it took a functional approach rather than a strict sovereignty approach to where the person is being held. But for this person, if they are in the United States and there's some kind of charge pending, or if there's no charge pending and they're being held indefinitely for deportation, they could file a habeas corpus to get them either to deport them or to hold a hearing and get some kind of resolution. Would you do the last one, Sonia, too? Because I just quoted something from Bowman, which might... this is, I think, what probably Judge Nevin and I would really agree on, and why I think it's really a great decision. That is, it's 5-4, and it could have been 5-4 the other way, but what Kennedy's really saying here is that liberty and security have some potential for being not, you know, mutually exclusive. And we can do that within the network of law. And what we can't do it in is if there is unilateral or secret action, you know, by one branch of the government. What democracy is about, and what, you know, Carol is saying, doesn't this have an effect on the enforcers? You know who the enforcers are?
Us.
You got it. This, we, Judge Evan has a stake in this, I have a stake in this, everyone in this room has a stake in it. No matter how much you dislike it, this is a democracy. And as long as it's a democracy, and it will only function as a democracy if we continue, you know, to claim our rights and to have discussions, then we have to claim what our country is doing, what
part
our policies
the challenge
are.
With that statement, though, is, and again, this gets at least the reauthorization of the Surveillance Act that was going through Congress now that offered immunity to the telecommunications companies that participated in the surveillance. How do you get standing? Because you can't, I mean, courts generally will not say you're welcome to file suit without standing, number one. And again, I think, at least when I see the history that you put up, it just, and I'm not an attorney, but it just reeks of the same kind of last 250 years of information there, which again goes to the Bill of Rights, which doesn't come with an asterisk. It says you've got the right to waive and pick and choose which of your rights you'd like to give up. And again, it says the right of the people to be secure in their persons, in their documents.
Well, there are many means. I don't mean to say a lawsuit is the only means. We've been talking a lot about lawsuits, but that's because it's talking about the principles that you're talking about. So it can be political action. It can be as many different things as you can think about. It's to, you know, raise your hand in this room and make a comment. It's to take this down the lake with you, you know, whatever your beliefs are, to, you know, engage in the whole system.
All right. It was interesting in this chronology that you put together about the fact that in some of the more egregious cases there seems to be sort of a relatively quick remedy, you know, as regimes change. So a question for either of you, I suppose, is, you know, I think it's clear to a lot of us that we have expended a huge amount of political capital, a huge amount of world standing in our foreign policy as we've gone through the last 7 years. Do either of you see the potential to regain that anytime soon in some sort of reparation?
No. I mean, I was in Sierra Leone in April, and I'm going to Congo in September, and I'm teaching rule of law, individual rights, gender equality, freedom of speech, you know, and it comes up. I was in Argentina two years ago, and it came up. It comes up in Africa, people are pretty nice about it. When it came up in Argentina, they were pretty pointed about it. You know, you don't turn that sort of thing around overnight. Do I think it's remediable? Yeah. Yeah. But I think it's going to, I think I think it may take a while. I don't mean to suggest that, because in my opinion at least, that we've compromised a certain amount of world standing or diplomatic capital, that necessarily, you know, we're somehow in a terrible position in the eyes of the world. Maybe, you know, there are those who believe we are. I don't know. But it's, yeah, we've lost a lot. And I don't think you turn that sort of thing around overnight. But do I think it's possible to get back? Yeah. Yeah, I do. I think so long as we have places like Guantanamo and we have the world debate on the war, I think the extent to which we can make any progress to accomplish that is pretty much going to be sort of in a holding pattern.
You want my opinion too, or? You know, I think beyond all those considerations, there are also, I think we need, this is like Professor Fettheim was saying. When I teach this course, I say, as a paradigm for the whole course, I put two things up at the start: domination and relationship. Sound familiar?
Yeah.
And when the United States learns that they need to be in relationship rather than to dominate, then we got a chance. And I don't know if that's ever going to happen, but I think we all need to try. And we all need to be engaged in that effort, whether it's as a Christian or in your profession or as a good parent or whatever it is. Yeah, I think that's kind of the bottom line. And you can't say you're in relationship with someone when, you know, you're causing hundreds of thousands of deaths, bombing them, or, you know, torturing people. I'll just end with this one story. There was my stepdaughter, who's getting married next week, Ricky's daughter, was down in Iowa, and she met this guy, a real interesting guy. This says something about relationship. And he was going out with, she was at Iowa Writer School, so they're in Iowa City. And this friend was going out with a friend to Kata, so Kata got to meet this guy who was a returned Iraq veteran. He had a PhD in Arabic, so the Army recruited him immediately to become an interrogator. And he was over in Iraq, and the first several interrogations he did, you know, the guys denied everything, and he just kind of wrote them off, and he wasn't involved in torture or anything like that. And he'd only done it a few days, and then the next guy who came in sat down with him, you know, like, as close as Jim and I were sitting down, and he said, you know, do you have a belief that America is evil, and would you like to exterminate Americans? And the guy said, well, of course. He said, you're in my country and you're killing my people. And he says, in my belief is that, you know, this is active infidels. And they began a discussion, and they had a long discussion, like for an hour, and they connected as people. And he realized that there was a lot to what this guy was saying, that if he'd been in the same position, he might have a lot of the same views. And they had disagreements and they had agreements. But what happened was relationship. He walked out of that room and he walked over and applied for CO status because he couldn't do any more interrogation because he'd been in relationship with that person. So when you ask that question, it opens up a lot broader considerations and ideas that I have. Thank you very much for coming.